Welcome to Double X Science. It's in your genes. Today is Saturday, May 18th, 2013. I am Adrienne Rorick, chemistry editor, and with me today is Jeffrey Perkel, tech editor at Double X Science. Good morning, Jeffrey. How are you?
Hi, Adrienne. I'm well, thank you.
This week I'm wondering, other than Double X Science, what activities do you do?
I'm a professional science writer, so I spend most of my time writing, but lately I've been taking flying lessons.
Flying lessons, that's pretty cool.
Yes. Yes, it's invigorating and a little bit scary.
What kind of plane do you fly?
It's a single-engine Cessna.
Okay.
A propeller plane.
Right, those are pretty much what people learn to fly on, right?
Yeah. Nice thing about that Idaho is it's not a lot of planes around and a lot of grassy fields and it's good weather. It's fun. It's great. It's expensive.
Well, everyone has to have one expensive hobby, right?
Exactly. And what about you?
Well, other than Double X Science, and I've talked about my day job in the past, one thing I've been working on a lot lately is an organization called Geek Girl Con, and I'm the manager of editorial services and the member of the board there. And what I do is I basically do more writing. I write copy. I write blog posts. I write announcements for their attendees. I copy edit when people submit things. So people are looking for more of my writing. They can always check out geekgirlcon.com. And it's actually a celebration of the female geek. It's in its third year. They have a convention in October in Seattle. So it's a lot of fun and people are interested in that they have a science track too, which I participate in Double X Science presented at last year. So it's a lot of fun.
Oh, very good.
Well, let's go on to our week of posts. So to start the week, of course, Sunday the 12th was Mother's Day, and we had a post called Dominance Alphas and Queens, Happy Mother's Day. And this was by Double X Science contributor Jacqueline Gill, and she talked about how different types of mothers are in nature. And so she covers bees and meerkats, killer whales or orca whales, and elephants as examples of maternal-led groups, social groups, and really gives an outline of all of those and gives some positives and negatives. For instance, positive on the elephants is that they have strong family ties and cooperative parenting, but the negative is there's a lack of mate control and the pregnancy takes 2 years. So, which I'm not sure anybody envies. The killer whales have a strong matrilineal line and a good family structure, but apparently the kids never leave home, so they are always in their orca pods. So it's really very interesting and a great celebration of mothers in the natural world that we had for Mother's Day. And then we turned to a post by biology editor Jeannie Garbarino called Thanks Mom for Not Eating Me. So we did not run this on Mother's Day because we thought that might not be the best idea since this is one's all about not caring mothers but rather mothers that eat their young. Of course, it's discussing cannibalism and how a mother, of course, needs to address her nutritional needs and so she may consume the weaklings of her brood in order to stay strong herself so that then she can raise the strongest young. It's a really interesting read about nature and motherhood in nature. But yeah, definitely not a post for Mother's Day.
On Tuesday, May 14th, we had a post from Matt Shipman. Matt is a science writer and public information officer at North Carolina State University, and he had a post called The Fatherhood Adjustment, which was part of the Evidence-Based Parenting Blog Carnival, which is a kind of a blog collective, I guess.
Yeah, Jeannie and I discussed that on a couple podcasts ago, so if people want to hear more about that, what that is exactly. There's a post on Double X Science about the Evidence-Based Parenting Blog Carnival and also a discussion on a podcast a couple weeks ago. I would have to look up for the one with Jeannie Garbarino, basically.
So it was a post called The Fatherhood Adjustment where Matt Shipman was talking about the keys to essentially being emotionally ready to be a father, and talks about why he was so ready. And basically, he talks about a 1982 study that identified four factors, essentially, that make the best fathers. One is, did the man want to become a father? Two, is he in a stable, loving relationship with his partner? Three, financial stability. And four, if a man feels like he's completed most of what he wanted to do before becoming a father. If you think about it, that's a perfectly obvious list, right? If you don't intend to become a parent, then you're probably not going to be super excited about it. Or if you feel like money is a problem, then obviously that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And if you've just want to spend your entire life going to bars or traveling, and you're going to end up resenting the child. He talks about his own state of mind when he became a parent, and he talks also about subsequent papers that talked about men freaking out during their wives' pregnancies and after the baby is born. And basically it was just an interesting perspective on fatherhood and the emotional preparation for fatherhood. And Matt concludes the post with some helpful information about essentially where to turn for help if you're feeling overwhelmed. He has a number of resources for people who might feel overwhelmed. And then on the next day, May 15th, we had a post from Sarah C.P. Williams entitled "Old Ovaries, New Eggs, Hatching a Debate." And it basically has to do with the scientific controversy that is ongoing regarding whether or not women are actually able to produce more eggs in their lifetime. So the conventional wisdom is that a female makes all of her oocytes early in life. Actually, I'm not sure if it's early in life or actually during development itself, but the point being that once they're made, and if you lose them, they're gone. Obviously, if there were some sort of ovarian stem cell that scientists could identify and be able to exploit, it might be possible to help infertile women, for instance, or women who've had to, say, undergo chemotherapy and therefore destroyed all their eggs, if they could then make new eggs. There's a lot of opportunities for cells like this if they exist. Basically, Sarah is talking about the fact that there was a recent paper by biologist Alan Spradling at Carnegie Institute for Science basically saying that such cells don't exist, but it's a controversial topic because there's another researcher at Massachusetts General Hospital who has claimed that they do exist. And the take-home message of this is that the science isn't settled, but just the general fact that everybody is doing this study, you know, ultimately should provide some sort of benefit.
I think that's very interesting because, as she said, it's been cited as fact that women are born with all their eggs or oocytes that they will ever have, and I remember I learned that. And the fact that you have researchers who are trying to challenge that, who are saying, is that really true? Sure, that's what the evidence has suggested all up to this point, but we might be able to find new things now. This is a great example, I think, of how science works, because this is something that was basically stated as fact that now new methods and whatnot that we are able to do in science may find something else, right? It may just reinforce what has always been said, or it might find something new. So I love this.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for the fact that conventional wisdom is only that. One of the nice things about science is you have to prove your assumptions. Now, obviously, Spradling, the researcher from Carnegie, obviously thinks that these cells don't exist. The title of his paper is female mice lack adult germline stem cells. But this other researcher at Massachusetts General Hospital, Jonathan Tilley, believes that Spradling's data could be interpreted in another way and support the existence of stem cells. So clearly more work needs to be done. And when that happens, everybody wins.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
On May 17th, we had a post from XX Science editor Emily Willingham called The Mammogram Labyrinth. It was obviously an on-the-fly post when Emily is relating a very personal story that she discovered a lump in her breast and she wanted to get a mammogram. She's recently moved, and so she talked about the difficulty that she had in scheduling that mammogram and getting her previous physicians who did her last mammogram to forward her records to the new office. They need the comparator set in order to be able to put the new data in context. The difficulty getting an appointment, the difficulty with privacy rules, the potential difficulties with insurance, and the fact she points out, which I thought was really, really smart, that at each of these points, a lot of women who might not have, you know, hours to spend on this, or who might not have easy access to a fax machine or any other thing, might just say, you know, I can't deal with this right now, and push a very important decision back. Emily had the resources and the time to spend and get her tests scheduled, but it's a really, I think, a really interesting piece from the point of view of people shouldn't have to wait for things like this. It shouldn't be this difficult to do something this important.
Oh yeah, she bolds in every few paragraphs. She discusses the obstacles she's encountered. She encountered in about an hour or so just spent trying to do this. Each hurdle or obstacle is a point at which a lot of women without her resources or time would probably drop the issue or delay or wait and possibly end up too long, especially if you're going in for a diagnostic mammogram. The longer you wait with all cancers, the less that can be done, basically.
Right. And I think at the end, she ends up spending more than 2 hours trying to make this appointment and get the previous record sent and filling out the paperwork to authorize.
Well, and she'll have to go to another appointment first.
She needs to get a referral appointment from her physician, but first they need to see the previous records. And I mean, you know, it's a ridiculous amount of hassle for something very clearly very important and time sensitive.
Right. Yeah,
so I recommend everybody read this post.
Well, and it blends really well with the post actually on the previous day called 10 Ways Healthcare Reform Might Help People with Disabilities, because this is, again, all about the healthcare you receive. And XX Science contributor Laura Newman, who has posted at the site before, discussed potential healthcare reforms that are under discussion and what that might do for the general population, but specifically people with disabilities. And she has a nice little slideshow to cover that. So that's a definite recommendation also to check that one out at the site.
And that posted May 16th.
Right. So for our I Am Mental Illness series, we had a post called Depressing Genes, where our contributor looked at the ability to take a look at what your genes are, especially with companies like 23andMe, what the information is that you can get back and what that might mean for you. So it's a post that has an interesting science-based point. It's a story of mental illness, but also a story of the science. So it's a slightly different twist, I think, on some of the posts we've had.
Right, and it talks a little bit also about the notion that genetics circumscribe us, but they don't define us.
Right. And you can find all those posts at our website, xxscience.org, by clicking on the links to the post title on the main page. In addition to our XX Science site postings, our sister site, XX Science Junior, had 3 posts this week. We had the development of critical thinking outside of school, blood plasma resembles ketchup, a discovery by our contributor, and Scrapyard Adventures, where a student went to the junkyard and took a look at some stuff, and it's actually kind of a photo blog where they have several pictures about the things they found and what they could do.
I thought the second piece on blood plasma and ketchup was very interesting. This is by a high school student named Alice. It basically just kind of looks at, probably everybody listening to this podcast has had a blood test. When your blood flows into those little vacutainer tubes, right, it just looks like red liquid, but actually it's composed of cells and it's composed of plasma. And plasma, although I never knew this, has the consistency of like Heinz ketchup, and it's really, really viscous stuff.
Hmm.
I thought it was very interesting. I thought it was a very interesting post by Alice.
Right,
basically, so if you put it between glass, and you can kind of see it stretch.
Huh. That is really interesting. So these posts at XX Science are always really good. They're written by students for other students their age, but I always think that everyone can get something out of it, especially. I like the pictures of the scrapyard adventure, and Jeff was particularly interested in blood plasma behaving like ketchup. So you can find these posts at xxsciencejr.blogspot.com or by following the link XX Junior site from xxscience.org main page. Now on to our news. Jeff, what science news have you been reading this week?
There's a very interesting development this week in the world of stem cell biology, published in the journal Cell by researchers at Oregon Health and Science University. These researchers have succeeded in cloning human stem cells by the same process that was used several decades ago to clone Dolly the sheep. If everyone remembers, that is the process called somatic cell nuclear transfer, where you take an egg, remove the nucleic acid material from the egg, and add the DNA from like a skin cell from the animal you want to clone. If everything works out properly, you can create a cloned animal, and this created Dolly the sheep. It's been done with certain animals, but it has never been able to work with humans. Some researchers believed it was impossible. And now these researchers in Oregon Health and Science University have shown that it is possible. They had to use some pretty clever tricks to make it work, including adding caffeine, actually. So they had to kind of hop up these cells on caffeine or something to make it happen. But basically the point is, these researchers are not actually interested in actually cloning a human being. What they're interested in is creating a source of stem cells that could be used, say, to repair damaged tissue in a person with a disease, like neurons or insulin-producing islet cells in a person who can't receive a transplant. Because obviously a clone cells would be immunologically the same as your normal cells, and so you don't need to be on immunosuppressants for the rest of your life. So that's what I was reading. How about you, Adrian?
Well, I was particularly interested in a news article that came out on May 13th by Hannah Hickey at the University of Washington. And the funny thing is Emily Willingham, our editor-in-chief, also was interested, and we both posted it on the Double X Science feeds. So if anybody, because I wasn't paying attention, I posted after her. And if anybody felt like we were kind of spammy with this article, it's just because we both thought it was perfect for our audience. It's about using earthquake sensors to track endangered whales. So the fin whale is the second largest animal ever to live on Earth, but it's also one of the least understood. It's very large, it's a big global range, and its call is at about 17 to 35 vibrations per second, which happens to overlap with the vibrations for seismic data. And so in the past, when they were recording earthquake data in the oceans, they would have these fin whale calls that were really a nuisance. But now a UW student in oceanography was comparing the calls by different spectrometer and was able to analyze them. And so they're actually learning a lot more about these endangered species, these fin whales that we don't know very much about, because of being able to track their calls with earthquake sensors. So this is really neat stuff.
Yeah, it's a really cool observation, really cool article.
Yeah. So, and I always love stuff like that. Well, that wraps up our week at Double X Science. Thank you, Jeff, for joining me today.
Thank you, Adrian. It was a good recording with you as always. In the future, you can look forward to posts from our physics editor, Matthew Francis, on Einstein and E equals MC squared. We've got a post coming up on adoptees. We've got posts about Dr. Oz, and I have a post about urinary tract infections and more about microbiomes.
Oh, this is your theme, isn't it? These microbiomes.
It seems to be, unfortunately.
Well, I look forward to those posts and getting to discuss them with you and the other members of the Double X Science team. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast via iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. If you are enjoying the podcast, please rate our podcast and leave a review at iTunes to help bring science to more people. Our music is provided by Editor-in-Chief Emily Willingham. Our artwork is by Dallas Lopez. Please like us on Facebook at /XXScience and follow us on Twitter at XXSci. This has been chemistry editor Adrian Rorick and tech editor Jeffrey Perkel. We are Double X Science, bringing science to the woman in you.